Here, I'll press that. There's a little. Well, good evening, everybody. I hope you can all hear me. You're very welcome indeed to this Gordon Science Lecture. It's very gratifying to see such a large number of people showing an interest in the subject. My name is Gareth Dalzell. I'm on the Ireland Committee for Christians in Science, and we organise these God and Science Lectures. And it's been a fair bit since we've had one, I think. This is our first for at least a year, I believe. So it's good to see everybody. We're very grateful to Barry Ford, Reverend Barry Ford, the minister here, who's very kindly hosting us and giving us great accommodation and great coffee and great biscuits. So this is the first of the lectures we have for this spring. It's from Dr. David Glass, and it's entitled "Can Science Explain Away God?" So we're very pleased to have Dr. David Glass with us. Dr. Glass is a lecturer in mathematics at the University of Ulster and has published widely in philosophy, maths, and physics, and he's the author of a great book, The Atheist's New Clothes. So strongly recommended that book. I'll hand over now to Dr. Glass, and please enjoy the lecture and get your questions ready. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Gareth, for your introduction and for the invitation to come along and speak at Christians in Science. It's a great privilege to be here. So I'm going to be looking at the topic, Can Science Explain Away God? And this is based on work carried out on a two-year project that is taking place at Ulster University along with my colleague, Dr. Mark McCartney, on the topic explaining and explaining away. This is a project that's funded by the John Templeton Foundation, and we're looking at a range of issues to do with the whole concept of explaining and explaining away in particular, and part of that then is how those notions apply to the science religion debates and issues surrounding that. Okay, so that's, I'm going to be giving a little bit of a flavour of that project, or at least some aspects of it, and look at how that might relate to some of the things that hopefully will be of interest to the group here this evening. So just to give you a very quick overview, my plan is to first of all look at science and God. Is there a necessary conflict between the two? Now, that first topic, that sounds like a very standard thing that I'm sure you've covered loads of times at Christians in Science Ireland and in previous talks. But I want to look at that very briefly at the start. The answer, in case you're wondering, is no. So there you go, that's been pretty much covered. But it's actually, I want to go beyond that. I want to use that as a starting point. And one of the things you might ask is, well, that sort of topic has been covered so much before, and is there anything new to say about it? And I hope there is, but let's see how that goes. In particular, I'm going to look at this notion of explaining away, and a popular notion that's related to it, that of Occam's razor. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about that. A key question is, when does explaining away occur? Now, this is not just in a science religion context, so I'm not going to be focusing all the time on science religion. You'll see what I will be focusing on in a while. But then I'm going to come back to the science-religion discussion and look at four ways that we might go about relating God and science. Now again, I suspect that's a topic that if you're interested in science and religion, you've probably looked at a lot before. But I've always thought of sort of God and science issues and debates about the existence of God on the one hand, and these different models for how science and God may or may not go together, as to a large extent separate issues, but in fact I think they're very important as to how they relate to each other in the context of that debate. And then, if time permits, towards the end, I'm going to look at some recent attempts to explain away God, or at least rather to use science to explain away God. So that's roughly where we're headed this evening. The idea of a necessary conflict between science and religion is very popular. It's common at a popular level. And so here we see Sam Harris, who is one of the leading figures of what has been called the New Atheism, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, and others also part of that movement. They've been very influential, particularly at a popular level. They've come in for a lot of criticism at a more scholarly level, but at a popular level, this idea that there's a necessary and ongoing conflict between science and religion is very common indeed. And so in his book, Letter to a Christian Nation, Harris writes that the truth, however, is that the conflict between religion and science is unavoidable. The success of science often comes at the expense of religious dogma. The maintenance of religious dogma always comes at the expense of science. You've got to choose. Science rules out religion, essentially. Religion excludes science. Now, that, I think, even for the new atheists is slightly overstated. Because I think when they're in their better moments, they will say that science doesn't absolutely rule out God. It doesn't disprove God. Rather, it kind of gets rid of the need for God. So there's this idea of this complete conflict. Science gets rid of God completely. On the other hand, maybe it doesn't absolutely disprove God. So what exactly is going on there? And that's part of what I'm going to look at. Now, one of the ways in which the new atheists emphasize a conflict is that science is based on evidence and religious belief is based on faith. And then they derive a conflict there because they claim that faith is believing things for which there's no evidence. Now, I'm not going to go there tonight, except to say that that really doesn't stand up to scrutiny. If you look at Christian understanding, certainly, of what faith is not simply believing something for which there's no evidence. Okay, so that would be the first thing I would say there. But anyway, this idea is popular, that there's this kind of necessary and ongoing conflict. So how might we respond to that? Well, I think there's a number of standard things we can say in response. Well, there just isn't a necessary conflict. I mean, there's science, a scientific law, and there being a God who created the universe. There's certainly no logical conflict between the two there. If you believe one, you're not somehow logically forced to disbelieve the other. So science doesn't disprove God. And as I say, I think even the new atheists recognise that. They don't claim to have a logical disproof for the existence of God. Another thing we might say in response is that science and God are compatible. And you'll often find this in Christian circles as a response. They'll say you don't have to choose. The two are compatible with each other. And that's right. And I think even the new atheists, strictly speaking, would recognise that. We might also point out that the founders of science believed in God. People like Kepler, like Newton and Galileo and so forth. These people believed in God. In fact, their belief in God was one of their reasons or motivations for doing science. And their science certainly didn't undermine their belief in God. In fact, in many cases, it made it stronger, I would argue. And lastly, we might say that there, just in the history of science, there's no ongoing conflict. Of course, we can identify a few issues where there are conflicts. I've already mentioned Galileo, a well-known conflict there. We can look at evolution and Darwin, well-known conflicts there. Beyond that, there's not so many. And indeed, when you look at the history of those particular cases, the conflicts are not nearly as clear-cut as you would imagine. There's all sorts of other historical factors going on. You'll find religious people on both sides of the debate. Frequently, you'll find scientists on both sides of the debate as well. So the history is far from clear, and it's certainly not one of ongoing conflict. But all those responses, I think, are right and appropriate to this idea that there's a necessary conflict. But two beliefs can be compatible with each other, and yet still be in competition. Okay. And so I don't think that the standard answer that is sometimes given by Christians and other believers in God, I don't think it's adequate. I don't think, well, it's good as far as it goes, let me put it like that. But I can understand why an atheist might look at that response and say, well, okay, they might be compatible, but that doesn't mean you should believe both. Loads of things can be compatible. All sorts of beliefs can be compatible with each other, but it doesn't mean you should believe them all. Mere compatibility isn't good enough. Okay. So I think looking at this, I can understand the mindset of an atheist who would say, well, that might be okay for you. Maybe you want to believe in both of these things, but for me, I just don't see any need for God. Well, let's think about explaining away. Now, let's set aside science and God for a moment and think about the nature of explaining away. So let's suppose you go out to your car in the morning and, of course, you have an important meeting and, you know, you're short in time and the car doesn't start. Now, if you're like me and you're not much of a car mechanic, you're not really likely to know what the problem is. But you do know something. You have this initial hypothesis that the battery is flat. There's a problem with the battery. And so if that were true, that would explain why, in fact, the car won't start. The evidence supports your hypothesis. It confirms the hypothesis. But then your friend comes along and offers an alternative hypothesis. That actually the problem is to do with the starter motor. Now, I'm getting out of my depth here in terms of how cars work, so just don't expect too much expertise here. Now, let's suppose that, very fortunately, your friend who just turns up happens to be a car mechanic. And he does whatever car mechanics do. He opens the bonnet and he looks in there, and whatever he does, I don't know how they do it, he says, it's not your battery. Well, in fact, he doesn't say it's that there's no problem with your battery. But what he does say is, the problem is with the starter. Now, remember your initial hypothesis was that there was a problem with the battery. And now what we have found out is that this alternative hypothesis is true, that there's a problem with the starter. Now, what should we conclude from that? Does that mean there's no problem with the battery? Are the two hypotheses in conflict with each other? Or in competition? Well, at one level, no. Right? I mean, there could be a problem with your battery and your starter. I mean, okay, it's really bad luck today, and you just have two problems with your car. That could be true. But assuming the car was working yesterday, there was no problem with either the battery or starter, you'd really need to be very unlucky. Okay. So, given that you know that the starter is the problem, there's no longer any good reason to believe there's a problem with the battery. Okay? It doesn't absolutely rule it out. The initial hypothesis could be true as well, but there's just no need for it once you know that the alternative hypothesis is true. And so what we'll say in this case is that the alternative hypothesis has explained away, it's removed the need for the initial hypothesis. Even though they're both compatible with each other. Okay, so you get the idea? They're compatible with each other, but there is still a sense in which they compete, and one can remove the need for the other. And in short, and we'll get to this in a while, but in short, I think that is what most atheists are getting at when they claim that science removes the need for God. It's not that they're incompatible, it's that it explains away the need for God. Well, explaining away is closely related to Occam's razor. So this is William of Ockham, one of the leading philosophers from the medieval period. And William of Ockham, he didn't use the term razor, as far as I'm aware. Nor did he ever write, or at least in the writings that we have access to today, he didn't right, entities should not be multiplied beyond necessity, but that phrase has become associated with his way of thinking. One that he did write was that it's futile to do with more things that which can be done with fewer. And Occam's razor is a very popular principle in science and widely used. And it can be used in slightly different ways, but the idea is you go for the simpler hypothesis. If you've got two hypotheses, let's say, to choose from, and they both account for the evidence, you go for the one that is simpler. Now, the way actually it's worded here is it's not just about simplicity in terms of, let's say, two hypotheses, but that you shouldn't go for too many entities. You shouldn't multiply entities more than you need to. And so the version of it that I will look at is in terms of explanation. There's no need for two explanations when one will do. That is my version of Occam's razor for the purpose of this talk. And in the context of science and religion, we can then express that as there's no need for two explanations, God and science, when one, science, will do the job on its own. That's roughly the idea. Sean Carroll is a leading cosmologist at Caltech in the US, and he, over the last few years, has entered the fray on some of these debates about the existence of God. And in an article that he wrote of the University of God, he put it like this. Over the past few hundred years, the progress of science has worked to strip away God's roles in the world. He isn't needed to keep things moving, or to develop the complexity of living creatures, or to account for the existence of the universe. 2,000 years ago, it was perfectly reasonable to invoke God as an explanation for natural phenomena. Now we can do much better. So you see the idea of explaining away. As science progresses and it explains more and more about how the world works, there's less and less room for God. Less and less that God needs to explain. And so God gradually gets squeezed out of the picture. He gets explained away. We'll come back to Carroll later if we have time. Now, the basic point I want to make about this is that you can't just appeal to Occam's razor and say, God and science, Occam's razor, get rid of God. It's not that simple. What you've got to do is to decide when explaining away occurs, or to put it another way, you've got to decide when it's appropriate to use Occam's razor. And that turns out to be quite a complicated matter. Now, here again, I think one of the things I want to say is that this is not just about God and science. This whole notion, and in terms of the project, where this idea of explaining away comes from, is in terms of probability theory, and you may or may not be pleased to know that I'm not going to go into the details of that this evening. I can see some people look a bit disappointed and others look quite pleased at that, but anyway, that's the way it is for this evening. But this is used in other areas. For example, in medical diagnosis, the same kinds of things crop up. A person could have two different conditions. They're not incompatible with each other, but yet the symptoms, if they're accounted by one, there's no good reason to believe that they also have the other condition, for example. And this occurs in many contexts. And so people working using probability theory in computer science, for example, to develop systems for diagnosis and that sort of thing, look at this whole notion of explaining away. And so that is the context for our project. Now, what I want to do is run through a few scenarios, mostly related to our car still, just to illustrate that it's not a very straightforward matter. So let's take the example I gave a few minutes ago. Your friend, your car mechanic friend, turned up, looked in the bonnet, and said it's your starter that's the problem. And in that case, that accounted for the evidence very well, and so it explained away your reason for believing that there was a faulty battery. But let's suppose your friend who turned up wasn't a car mechanic. And your friend turns up, looks in the bonnet and says, I think the problem's with the starter. And you say, so how do you know that? And he says, oh, I'm just guessing. Now, would that explain away your belief that it may well be the battery that's a problem? No. The mere possibility that it might be a problem with the starter isn't good enough to explain away your belief that you might have a faulty battery. Okay. If he knows that it's the starter that's a problem, okay, that might do the job of explaining away. But if he's only guessing, that's not going to be good enough to explain away. So that's one problem. A second one is, let's suppose the starter, that the hypothesis that there's a problem with the starter doesn't really account for the evidence. I don't know, some of you will know more about this than me, but there might be certain signs when you turn your key, you can tell I'm out of my depth here, that will not be accounted for by the starter. The starter being the problem wouldn't explain certain signs. And so if that is the case, the starter isn't going to explain away the battery, the faulty battery hypothesis. So in order to explain away, there must be good reason to believe that it's true, or at least some reason to believe that it's true, and it needs to account for the evidence on its own. Okay, so that's two challenges if we want explaining away to work. Now let's turn to a slightly different example. Now, okay, I said I'm not an expert in car mechanics, but even I know that a flat tire is not going to stop my car from starting. That can't be the explanation for the car not starting. But I might have a flat tire. So I might have the belief that there's a flat tire. And then my friend says, the reason the car won't start is because of a starter problem. Well, will that explain away my belief that that the car is a flat tire? Well, of course not. The two have nothing to do with each other. I don't believe that the car is a flat tire because this would explain why the car won't start. I mean, I'm not that silly. So the fact that the starter explains why the car won't start won't explain away my belief that the tire is flat. Now, you might think, why on earth did he introduce that example? What has that got to do with anything? But trust me, or at least wait a bit longer and see. Okay, let's try a further scenario. Let's suppose my friend comes along and says, the reason why your car won't start is because it's not getting any power. There's no electrical power reaching the ignition. Now, would that explain away my belief that there's a faulty battery? But no, it's a faulty battery is the cause. It's the reason why there's no power getting to the ignition. So in fact, the faulty battery is what explains this, and there being no power explains why the car won't start. And so there's no explaining away going on here. The two hypotheses fit together perfectly. And there was no explaining away going on up here either. Now, let's turn to one final scenario, and this is away from the car not starting. Let's take a different scenario. Let's suppose an accident has occurred, a road traffic accident, and the initial hypothesis is that it was due to drink driving. Alcohol was the explanation for the accident, or at least that's the hypothesis. But then further evidence comes to light that supports an alternative hypothesis, or at least another hypothesis, that the car went through a red light. And that is what caused the accident. It was the car going through the red light. Now, does this second hypothesis, going through the red light, explain away the hypothesis that it was due to drink driving? Well, of course not. Again, the two go together. In fact, arguably, it could well have been the alcohol that caused the person to go through the red light. And so again, these two hypotheses can go together. The second one does not explain away the first one. Now, the basic point I want to make in all of these examples is that there are multiple ways in which explaining away can fail to occur when there are two hypotheses. It's just not automatic. If you want to argue that explaining away occurs, you're going to have to go through some of these issues and explain why you think explaining away occurs in a given scenario. And one of the things that we've done as part of our work is to look at the probability theory of this, but then from that try to extract certain questions that we need to answer. And so here are some of the questions. When we think about two hypotheses, are they irrelevant to each other, like the flat tire and the starter problem? If they're irrelevant to each other, explaining away isn't even on the agenda. Are they compatible with each other? Well, if they're incompatible, then explaining away very definitely is on the agenda, because if they're incompatible and we have good reason to believe one, then we have good reason not to believe the other. Okay. But if they are compatible, well, it's not so clear then. Explaining away may or may not occur. Thirdly, how well does the alternative explanation account for the evidence? If it accounts for the evidence really well, if it's just what we would expect if the alternative hypothesis is true, then that helps the case for explaining away. But if it doesn't account for the evidence in question, it's not so clear that it does much in terms of explaining away. Is the alternative hypothesis known to be true? Remember my friend who was just guessing that it was a problem with the starter? That's not good enough for explaining away. We must have some reason for believing that the alternative hypothesis is true. And finally, does the alternative hypothesis depend on the initial one? Because if it does, then the alternative isn't going to explain away the initial one. Just as going through the red traffic light didn't explain away the drink driving hypothesis. Okay, so you may or may not be interested in the detail of those questions. You may or may not be interested in the sort of probability that lies behind it. But for the purposes of my talk this evening, the main point I want to make here is that explaining away is a difficult business. You need to think about the issues very carefully, about the nature of the two hypotheses and how they relate to each other, in order to determine whether explaining away is going on. Well, with all of that, now let's try and see how that might be related to God and science. And this is why I think it's important that we consider different models or different ways of representing a relationship between God and science. And the first one I have here is the independent view. God is completely independent of science and the natural world. A bit like the flat tire, remember, and the starter, and the car not starting. Now, this is quite a popular view in certain circles. It's the idea that science deals with the facts about the natural world. And so, if we're dealing with evidence and the facts about the natural world, that's where science comes into play. If we're thinking about meaning and purpose and value and things like that, that's the realm where God comes into play. And you can believe in God, and you can believe in science, and there's no incompatibility, but more to the point for our purposes tonight, there's no explaining away. Because the two issues are just separate. The science being true gives us no reason to undermine God, because God has nothing to do with it. So this is a very neat solution in terms of avoiding explaining away, but it comes at a high price for the theist, and it certainly comes at a very high price for the Christian theist, because Christians believe that God created the world. In fact, not only did God create the world, but he sustains the world. And not only that, but when we look at the motivation for doing science that many of the founders of science had, it was because of their belief in God that I talked about earlier. And surely God is not somehow separated from the facts of the natural world. Certainly not if it's Christianity that's on the table. So, whilst it avoids explaining away, this is not a good model for the theist to adopt. Here's another one. Another model. I'm not sure if this is the best name for it, but it's the one I come up with. God as the cause of science. So here the idea is that God is not completely irrelevant to things anymore. Science accounts for the sort of facts of the natural world. But then we take a step back and say, but what accounts for science? What explains why we have scientific laws in the first place? What explains the order in the universe? And we might appeal to God as an explanation for those kinds of things. So, when it comes to particular aspects of the universe around us, we don't, for example, say that when we look at the motion of the planets in the solar system, we don't say, well, we're going to explain that by God wanting them to move in ellipses of certain sizes, okay? Rather, what we do is we say, well, that's something for science to explain. And science accounts for that remarkably well. But now we can take a step back and we can look at Kepler's laws or whatever and say, well, why is the universe like that? And when we ask that question, we can say, well, that makes a lot of sense if you believe in God. And so God explains why the universe is like that. It explains why these scientific laws exist. This is a very common model of the relationship between God and science, and it's very popular. Quite popular in Christian circles too. The good news is that this avoids explaining away. If you adopt this approach, then the success of science arguably does not explain away God. There's no potential really for it to do so. But the question I have is, what difference does God make? And I think there's a bit of a challenge here for this view, because whilst I'm kind of torn, because I can see the positives here. I can see why we would want to say, when we look at the laws of nature, that certainly makes sense to me as a believer of God. But I think I want to say more than that. I want to say that at least some of the specific features of the world around us make much more sense, given the existence of God. Let me go on to an example of this, just to illustrate the point. Now, I go into deep waters here, and it's not the main purpose of my talk this evening, but let me just try to illustrate the point by relating this to evolution. I know that's a silly example, just to illustrate a point, because it raises all sorts of other questions. But anyway, let me try and throw open a bit of discussion later, perhaps, about this. So, here's a standard way of thinking about this. If you believe that God used evolution, and as I said, that's not my topic for discussion this evening, but let's just assume that's true, that evolution's true and that God has used evolution. Well, then I think what you might want to say is something like this. If we want to explain the existence of complex life on Earth, well, we don't bring in God to explain that. Evolution is what explains that. But then you might take a step back from that and say, but why evolution? Why does evolution work? How does that come about? You need the right kind of universe. It depends on various physical laws for evolution to operate. It requires a fine-tuned universe. It requires all these things in the background. And so we might say, we need God to give us that, to give us the scientific laws, if you like, that are necessary for evolution to work. But once evolution gets up and running, it explains the existence of complex life. Now, so far, that seems reasonable, but again, I want to ask the question, what difference does God make to this picture? Is complex life more likely if God exists, or if God doesn't exist, or does it not make any difference? What's the probability that intelligent life would come about in an atheistic universe by evolution? What's the probability that intelligent life would come about by evolution in a theistic universe? Now, I think this raises a question for the idea that, for a theistic evolution view. Not that it means God didn't use evolution, but it raises the following question. What difference does God make? Okay. Here's where I think there's a bit of a tension. Some people will want to say the following. They'll want to say, well, look, evolution is just a scientific theory. Atheists believe in it. theists believe in it, and, you know, evolution doesn't settle the issue one way or the other. It's kind of neutral. That's one thing a theistic evolutionist might want to say, but here's another thing that I think a theistic evolutionist might want to say, and indeed I think should say, is that actually intelligent life is much more likely to come about by evolution in a universe created by God than in an atheistic universe. And so God makes a difference. And so if this is the model, I think it has some weaknesses, because it doesn't allow for that. Okay? Plenty of food for thought there. Okay, so we've looked at two models. We've looked at the independent one. We've looked at God as the cause of science, which is a lot going for it, but I have some reservations. Let's look at this other one. Now, you'll see the diagram here looks very much like our car nut starting earlier. It's the same structure of diagram. And this is what I call the indirect conflict model. It's basically the sort of explaining away scenario. You'll see that God isn't the cause of science here. There's no direct relationship. And so in this model, God and science are kind of treated as separate entities to account for the evidence. Now, all I want to say is that this model offers the most scope for explaining away. It doesn't guarantee explaining away will occur, but it does offer the most scope for it. And fortunately, I think it's also a pretty poor model of the relationship between God and science. Because I think a much better one is this one. The integration model is my name for it. And the only difference is it is this extra arrow between God and science. It's saying that we still need an explanation for those scientific laws. And I would say God gives us a very good explanation. The existence of God gives us a very good explanation as to why there is order in the universe as expressed in the laws of science. And so in this model, a bit like the earlier diagram, it doesn't absolutely rule out explaining away, but it's plenty of scope for avoiding it, because science arguably depends on God. The scientific laws, why they exist in the first place. And so there are two ways in which science, if you like, can have an impact on belief in God. One in this way, which could be explaining away, and one this way, in that science itself arguably requires a God to explain the success of science and the laws of science and so forth. Now, of course, this will have to be applied in any particular context, and the sorts of questions we'd need to ask are the sorts of questions we were looking at earlier. In any given case, do we know that the scientific theory is true? Or do we have good reason to believe it? How well does it account for the evidence that we find in the natural world in a particular case? Does the science require a designer, require God? And so on. Now, what I want to say is that you might think the idea that this doesn't absolutely rule out explaining away is a weakness. But in fact, I think it's a strength. Because I think that in principle, there could be some aspects of science that would undermine at least certain reasons for belief in God. Let me give you one. Let's suppose that I have some miraculous, or at least apparently miraculous, recovery of a terminally ill patient has taken place after people have prayed for that individual. Science can't explain it, and indeed when we look at the evidence, when we look at the nature of the case, when we look at the kind of criteria we might use to determine whether a miracle has occurred, or at least whether it's plausible to believe in one, we might have pretty good grounds for saying this looks pretty much like a miracle. And if that's the case, that would provide a reason for belief in God. But let's suppose then that science, a few years later, actually gives us a very good and straightforward explanation as to why this person recovered. Now, that doesn't disprove God. Of course, there's loads of other reasons for belief in God, and I think that's an important point to make here. At least I think there is. But in that particular case, science could remove that one particular reason for belief in God. It could explain away that reason for belief in God, and so could undermine belief in God a little bit. So I don't think we should just say science could never undermine belief in God. And furthermore, I don't think we should say science could never, in principle, undermine any of our Christian beliefs. In fact, I think that's one of the strengths of the Christian faith, is that it is open to refutation. Certainly when you look at the early followers of Jesus, if the body of Jesus had been produced after they had claimed that he was resurrected from the dead, Christianity would have come to a pretty abrupt end. But of course that didn't happen. So, in principle, it could be undermined by science or by the evidence. So, here's the summary. I've looked at four views on the relationship between God and science. In the end, and what I've tried to do then is to assess them in two respects. One, in terms of how good they are, just as a way of explaining the relationship between God and science. And secondly, in terms of whether they avoid explaining away. So just to summarise, the independence model is very good at avoiding explaining away. It absolutely rules it out, but it does so at the expense of not being a very good model. The second model that God causes science also rules out explaining away, and whilst it has its strengths, I also think it has limitations. The third one is the indirect conflict model. It's the weakest in terms of avoiding explaining away. It has the most scope for explaining away to occur, but along with the independence model, it's the worst in terms of a model of the relationship between God and science. And lastly, the one which, as you've gathered, I favour, is this integration model, which I think is a good model of the relationship between God and science. And although it doesn't absolutely avoid explaining away, it has good scope for doing so. So I think it's reasonable on those grounds. Now, the importance of this is that when it comes to arguments about God and science, it's very easy for a sort of shouting match to occur on both sides of the debate. And one of the things that I'm trying to do tonight, and that we're trying to do in this project, is to say, well, let's dig beneath the surface a little bit, and let's think about what the issues are. How exactly is science meant to undermine belief in God? And what I'm proposing, and if you're an atheist, I would suggest you take this seriously, that here is a way for you to argue your case. You've got to argue that scientific theories explain away the need for God. But what I'm also saying is, that's not going to be straightforward, and there's plenty of resources for those of you who do believe in God to respond to that. Furthermore, I think we need to think about, when these sorts of arguments are being put forward, are people assuming a particular model of the relationship between God and science? And often they are. Often, the loudest voices are assuming something like this indirect conflict model. And I think we really need to question that. Okay, well, with all of that in mind, let me, for the remaining time, take a quick look at a few recent attempts to try to use science to explain away or undermine belief in God. And the first one is the new atheism. And here is Richard Dawkins. Who else? Okay. So in his book, The God Delusion, Dawkins writes that historically religion aspired to explain our own existence and the nature of the universe in which we find ourselves. In this role, it is now completely superseded by science.
you get the idea. I think this is an explaining away argument. As science explains more and more about the world, God, who used to be there as an explanation, is just not needed anymore. And when you look at the New Atheist writings on this topic, I think it can be summarized. Now, I know there's different aspects to their case, but I think in terms of this kind of argument that Dawkins is advancing, it goes something like this. Science explains. It explains a lot. Of course it does. It explains a lot about the natural world around us. And it's very successful in that. Secondly, it's an appeal to Occam's razor. Now, they don't always mention Occam's razor. Christopher Hitchens does. The others don't. But it's clear that something like that is in their reasoning. There's no need for God and science. But science will explain everything on its own. Now, one thing I want to say about this, just going back to the idea that science explains, of course, one of the things we might want to raise here is, well, science doesn't explain everything. There's loads of things science doesn't explain. But anyway, we'll leave that just for the moment. It does explain a lot, no question. So science explains a lot about the world around us, and then we use Occam's razor to say that therefore science explains away God. Or at least it removes God from all those areas that he was used to explain in the past. Now, there's all sorts of problems here. One of the problems is, let's suppose this argument works. Let's suppose he's right. Well, there's still loads of other reasons, I would argue, for belief in God, or at least it's plausible to think so. For example, what about the moral argument for God's existence? Okay. Science doesn't explain away that. There's all sorts of other things that science can't explain as well. Does it explain why there's a universe at all? And so there we have a cosmological argument for the existence of God that science arguably doesn't touch upon. So even if Dawkins' argument were successful, there may well be many other reasons for believing in the existence of God. So it's very weak on that front. But even in terms of just explaining away God from a scientific context, that the things God used to explain there's no longer any need for, I think it's very weak in this respect as well. For two reasons. One, because I think it assumes something like this indirect conflict model. God and science doesn't need God at all. Okay. And so once we know that scientific theories are true, there's no longer any need for belief in God. And secondly, in terms of Occam's razor. Well, you just can't go about applying Occam's razor like that, just as if it's obviously applied to these sort of scenarios. That's the whole point of my talk this evening. You've really got to do your homework and decide, well, does Occam's razor apply in this or that particular case? Occam's razor is a great instrument for science, but in the wrong hands, as with any other kind of razor, Occam's razor can be a very dangerous instrument, and it certainly is in the hands of the new atheists. Let's go to Sean Carroll. I mentioned his work earlier on, so let me just turn to it very briefly. In his article, and he doesn't have the same sort of tone as the new atheists, it's much more moderate, I would say, and I think he gives us a good insight as to why many scientifically minded atheists don't believe in God. But I think by looking at his case, we can also see where the weaknesses lie, and I'll mention just a couple. In an article, the article I mentioned earlier, Does the Universe Need God? Basically what he does, or his main focus, is looking at theistic appeals to, for example, the Big Bang and fine-tuning and cosmology as reasons for belief in God. And he's responding to that. And a couple of things, I mean, there's much more that could be said about this article, but a couple of things where I think he goes badly wrong is that he treats theism like a rival scientific theory. So he says, for example, that God is essentially never invoked in scientific discussions. Yes, and what exactly is that supposed to show? I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, when you look at the work of Kepler or Newton or whoever, the reason for believing in God is not because God has to appear in their equations. That's his other comment. God is not described in equations. Well, Kepler and Newton and so forth didn't think that because God didn't appear in their equations, that it somehow undermined the need for God. This is just the wrong way to think about the relationship between God and science. God is not another rival scientific hypothesis. For you get all your scientific theories and cosmology on the table and you put God in as an extra one of them, and if you find out that one of the others is true, God is off the table. It's just the wrong way to think about it. What we've got to do is do the science and then step back from that and say, well, does this fit better with belief in God or with atheism? The other thing that he does is to appeal to the possibility of cosmology's avoiding the beginning and the possibility of a multiverse. And so he says, well, you can't rule out these things. There are various theories out there. Some of them avoid a beginning to the universe. Some of them appeal to a multiverse. But we saw the problem with that earlier. Merely appealing to the possibility of an alternative hypothesis is nowhere near good enough for explaining away. Remember my friend who said that it might be a problem with a starter? That's not going to do enough work for explaining away to take place. And so I think this is a weakness in Carroll's argument as well. Okay, now finally what I want to look at are two, I think, much more sophisticated cases for trying to argue from the success of science to naturalism. And these are by philosophers Paul Draper and Gregory Dawes. Now, I don't have time to look at their arguments in detail. There's a lot of overlap between the two. And in fact, what I'm going to focus more on is Paul Draper's argument. The first thing, though, that I want to say about this is, as part of the project, I was looking at this, and one of the things I wanted to do was to say, well, okay, this idea that science undermines belief in God is very common at a popular level. But let me now go to the philosophers. They're supposed to be the experts in these sorts of arguments, after all, about the existence of God. And find the best arguments that have been used by philosophers using science to undermine belief in God. Explaining away type arguments. And the thing that surprised me was that they were so few and far between. This idea that science is one of the main reasons for rejecting belief in God, as I say, is very common, very popular in the new atheism and so forth. But when you go to atheistic philosophers, they very, very rarely seem to use this kind of argument. There are other arguments, of course, they use, and I'm not discussing those tonight. The problem of evil is foremost, of course. And there are other arguments that atheistic philosophers will use too. But appealing to the success of science is relatively rare. Now, I'm not saying Draper and Dawes are the only two to attempt this argument, but of the ones I came across, they were far and away the best arguments. Anyway, that's sort of by the by, and I think that it's an interesting point. Certainly it was interesting to me. I expected to find many more such arguments. Okay, so let's see how it goes. One of the interesting things about both Draper and Dawes is that they kind of start with issues relating to the intelligent design debate. One of the things that many Christians have said about intelligent design is about this issue of what's called methodological naturalism, that when we're doing science, we should only look for natural explanations and we should exclude the supernatural. People who favour intelligent design have argued against that. People who are against intelligent design have said, yes, we should exclude the supernatural, even Christians. The interesting thing about Draper and Dawes is they adopt the intelligent design viewpoint. They say, well, there's no good reason whatsoever to exclude God. I mean, if God turns out to be the best explanation for some feature of the natural world, we shouldn't limit our explanations to purely natural explanations. I thought that was interesting. Two leading atheists who take that view. Nothing very much follows from it, but anyway, I thought it was an interesting point. And they use that as a sort of starting point for their argument. And the first point is that theism does not guarantee that explanations will be natural. There's no good reason to think that God, in other words, couldn't be the best explanation for certain natural phenomena, if there's a God. Naturalism, point two, by contrast, does guarantee that explanations will be natural. Of course, because naturalism says there are no supernatural entities, there are only natural ones, and so any explanations must be natural. Now, the other point they make is that although there's no good reason in principle to exclude God, in practice, we don't need him. In practice, science is remarkably successful just by appealing to natural explanations. And they argue, given the first two points, or Draper's argues, the success of natural explanations in science is much more to be expected if naturalism is true than if theism is true. Okay. The success of natural explanations in science explaining so much of the world is just what we'd expect if naturalism is true, but not if theism is true. And so this counts as evidence in favour of naturalism. And that, in a nutshell, is Draper's argument. Now, one thing I will say about this is much more modest than the New Atheists. He's not claiming that this argument shows there's no God. He's just claiming that this undermines one reason for belief in God, that science provides some reason against God. He's not claiming that there are no other reasons for belief in God. Although, in fact, he has also argued from the problem of evil. Well, let me then take a look at a couple of these claims. That theism doesn't guarantee that explanations will be natural. Well, that's true, I think. And it doesn't guarantee that. But, I would argue, it does give us good reason to expect natural explanations to be successful in general. It doesn't guarantee that there will never be that natural explanations will never fail, but it does give us good reason to expect them to be generally successful. That's what I mentioned earlier. Kepler and Newton and so forth, they expected to find laws of nature because of their belief in God. And in fact, I think Draper is sort of aware of this himself, because although he says you can't rule out God from acting in the world, he says also religious people would have good reason to believe that God wouldn't be just acting all over the place. And sort of, because if that were the case, it would be, the world would be unpredictable, we wouldn't be able to figure out how things work. If God acts, we would still expect there to be law-like behaviour and regularity in nature. So I think this first claim that theism doesn't guarantee that explanations will be natural, although true, it doesn't carry much force. And secondly, that naturalism does guarantee that explanations will be natural, well, again, that's true. But two questions. First of all, why expect the universe to be governed by laws in the first place if naturalism is true, if there's no God? I've already been making that point. And secondly, why think that we would be able to discover them, even if there are such laws? Why should it be that human minds are so constituted as a result of an evolutionary process that we, using our human minds that evolved for the purposes of our survival, should be so adapted to enable us to discover the mysteries of the universe? It's very hard to see a reason for that, given naturalism, whereas given theism, well, again, this goes back to the early scientists. They believed that they were made in the image of God, and so we should at least partially be able to understand something about the universe God has made. As Kepler put it, we would be able to think God's thoughts after. Neither Draper nor Dawes rule out the possibility of theism. So again, their arguments are more modest. But, and here's a key point, For theism to be successful, there would have to be some feature of the natural world where science would break down. Okay, that's their claim.
So they're not as hostile as the new atheists at all. But the only way that theism could be shown to be successful is if science breaks down and theism offers us a better explanation in some case. And that is just a mistake, I would say, about the relationship between God and science. It seems to assume something like the indirect conflict model. Okay, that if you have science, there is no need for God. And that needs to be argued for in great detail. You can't just assume that if you've got science, you get rid of God. And that is the basic point, I suppose, I'm making this evening. Dawes, for example, appeals to a sort of version of Occam's razor. But again, the point I've been making is you really need to be very careful in your use of Occam's razor. And so to conclude, I think there's a challenge for theists. I think we can respond to the atheistic objections to belief in God based on science. But sometimes I think we don't do a great job of this. We'll say, well, you can believe in God and science, the two are compatible, and so forth. But if that's all we say, I think we've maybe failed to understand exactly what the objection the atheist is making. And it's something along the lines of Occam's razor, that there's no need, when science accounts for so much, it's not that this disproves God, but just that there's no need for him. And so I think we need to, if we really want to engage in that argument, I think we need to think about how we respond to that. I think there's also a challenge for atheists here, that they need to grasp what's required to make explaining away arguments plausible. And I think they've just failed to do this. Explaining away is much more difficult, is the point I've been making, and I think that in many of the cases I've looked at, particularly the new atheists, they just haven't even begun to grasp what is required to show that explaining away works in the case of God and science. And so there's no easy way to move from science explains to science explains away. And finally, I would like to highlight that point again, that merely appealing to possible scientific explanations of multiverses or whatever is nowhere near good enough for an explaining away argument to be successful. So that's the end of my talk. Just to highlight a couple of places where you'll find some resources. The project website, there you can find. You'll find some of the articles, including a paper that looks at some of those notions about explaining away and the questions I mentioned, and also another website that I'm involved in with Saints and Skeptics. Okay, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Is that on? Yeah, can you all hear me? Thank you very much, Dr. Glass. Some very clear, focused content to get our minds focused. Now, I know there are a lot of very clear thinkers here present, and I'm sure there are a lot of questions. So, if you have a question, raise your hand and give us a shot. Mark?
Yep. I'm intrigued by your integration model, and in particular the bottom left arrow, because as I understand it, to explain things in the natural world, it could either be by the hypothesis of science, which with God, or directly that God is the explanation. Now, before science, everything would have been in that bottom left arrow. You know, God is the explanation for everything that is around. And then, as science develops, things move from that arrow to via science. Now, is that not a God of the gaps? Does that not mean that as science explains more and more, there is less substance to that bottom left arrow?
So, is this arrow you're talking about?
The one from God to natural world.
Good question. So,
what I want to say about that arrow is as follows. If we go back to the previous case, the sort of model that doesn't have that arrow, what this is saying is that if we take something like intelligent life, that given science, there's no more reason to expect intelligent life given God than there is given atheism. So when I put in that arrow, I want to say that that's not the case. I want to say that actually in a theistic universe, I think intelligent life, to take that particular example, is more likely to occur. The reason for that is because I think most people will want to set something like the following. So just assuming in that case, taking evolution for granted in that case, I think most people will say that, you know, even though God may well have used evolution, that God nevertheless guided the process in some way. Various models in the field of science and religion, people have discussed different models by which that process might have occurred. And they're not proposing those typically as scientific hypotheses. They're just saying, well, as Christians, we believe that God has interacted in the world in some way, guiding the processes to his desired outcome, if you like. In various models, including guiding things at quantum level or something like that. But whatever the mechanism, that somehow God has guided those processes, and so intelligent life would be more likely to arise, to occur in a theistic universe than in a theistic one. And that's why the arrow is there. At least that's my reason for putting it in, if that answers your question. But feel free to come back. Well, let me add one more thing, perhaps, there. Let's suppose we didn't have evolution as a scientific theory. Let's suppose that weren't even on the table. Well, you might say that the relationship here would be stronger because of the absence of a scientific account. But that would give more reason to believe in God, and that would be one possibility. So I allow for that by saying, well, there might be some scope for thinking explaining the way it occurs in this way. Science accounts for the evidence and so undermines. So these red arrows here could be undermining belief in God to some extent, but then we've got to take account of this one too. That evolution itself requires the right kind of scientific laws and so forth to be in place, and so it's far from obvious that it does any explaining away.
That's fine.
Okay, thanks. Any more? Okay, well, there must be more questions out there.
I'll bring the microphone over.
The weakness that I see in the materialistic explanation of the universe is that it does explain a lot. I mean, science has been tremendously successful, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that the starting point is the weak point. And that's fatal. If you can't start properly, you can't get anywhere. And it's the question of where does the first thing comes from?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe more specifically, how does life come out of nothing, one life? Science makes, in the eyes of some, reasonable efforts in explaining the increased complexity, etc., of life. But it never explains the origin of life. And therefore, it is not a complete explanation. And therefore, you could argue that something else is required, maybe on the non-physical level. Yeah? And you say that, why do you have shed thoughts in the brain? For the Christian, please, you have shed thoughts.
I think there is a problem for naturalism in terms of a beginning. So let me take that example of the beginning of the universe just to illustrate the point here. So personally, I think there is, I haven't been focusing on reasons as such for belief in God. What I've been looking at is attempts to explain away those reasons, if you like. So if we take something like the Big Bang,
at the universe at the beginning, then it seems to me that there is a very plausible reason here for belief in God. If the universe at the beginning, in fact, it seems almost like a dead giveaway to me, how can that come about if there's no God? A universe just can't come into existence out of nothing. So I think there really is a lot of explaining away needed for naturalism, given the Big Bang. So what are they to do? Well, what Sean Carroll does is to offer possible alternative cosmologies that avoid a beginning. Now, if we did have such cosmologies, if we knew that one of those was true, or a very good reason to believe that one of those was true and the universe probably didn't have a beginning, then that would weaken that kind of argument. It would at least partially explain it away. I suppose my point here is that merely to offer those as possible alternatives is nowhere near good enough, though, to undermine that argument. And so I would say that just by offering these alternatives, it does little to weaken the strength of that argument that the beginning of the universe points to God. So I think on that example of a beginning, I think there is a real problem for naturalism, and I think the attempts to explain it away are just not sufficiently good. Now, we could then discuss whether the same is the case with regard to the beginning of life.
But when you go that way and you say that the universe has always been,
yeah,
you make a statement that is thoroughly unscientific, because there is no evidence for it. I mean, science is based on following the evidence where it goes.
Yeah.
And there is no evidence, it's pure conjecture. So that isn't counted against God,
that
counts against natural science.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the thing that I'd want to say is, let's suppose science were to develop to a point where there was just no good reason to believe in a beginning. It's sort of like back to pre-Big Bang days. Before any evidence for a beginning came along, then there wasn't a very strong, well, in fact, there was an older argument based on thermodynamics, but we'll set that aside. Without good evidence for a beginning, we might say, well, there's just not much here that is a strong pointer to belief in God. I mean, there could be all sorts of other reasons for belief in God. So I suppose I'm just saying that in principle, science could get back to that point. But it seems to me that in the current evidence, the evidence for a beginning is very, very good, and I think the attempts to undermine that are pretty weak. Yeah.
Another question here. I said, I think it's important for us to consider that this is quite a Western problem. And I'm not saying that to shame or the West, but it is stemmed from Greek and Hellenistic thinking. And even when you take into consideration arguments of Plato and Socrates brought forth, particularly when they begin to discuss mental illnesses and things like that, they made room for the supernatural, and they made room for something that extended beyond the natural. And even those men who've been held up as the paradigms of atheism, and they always made room for the supernatural. And I think if you look at a Hebrew way of thinking or an African way of thinking, there is always room for the supernatural. And so I think when you're trying to explain and try to encapsulate God into the natural ways of man, then there will always be, you can never really explain it. So in a sense, the playing field that we started playing on is not even at the very beginning, because people have really come with their own conceptions and their own ideas and their own misunderstandings. So for a Christian and for someone like yourself to try and enter into that sphere of thinking and those realms of understanding, it's always going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks for that. I'm sure you're right to a large extent that this is a Western problem. I suspect that is right. I think what I want to say about that is first of all, I think when you look at the objections and
So you're absolutely right, there is this exclusion of the supernatural. I mean, that's a sort of starting point for a lot of these people. And I think sometimes what's happening, and certainly not for all of them, and there are differences between atheists, and I think we've got to make that clear. Not all atheists are just ruling out the supernatural completely. But I think the new atheists come very close to that. And they like to give the impression that it's science that is undermining belief in God. Whereas, I think you're right, I think God is more or less excluded from the outset. And that's sort of their starting point. Now, in terms of engagement with that, though, I think what I would want to say in response to that is to say that you might be right, it might be difficult, but I don't think we have an option. We might have an option in other parts of the world. We might have had an option here in the past, but I don't think we have an option here anymore. Because whether we like it or not, these people, the new atheists, for example, are very influential in promoting this idea that the supernatural should just be excluded, almost without argument in many cases. It should be ridiculed instead. And so I think one of the things we need to do is to try to identify where they're going wrong when they present their arguments and try to present a different kind of case. We might need to present the same sorts of arguments in other contexts and other cultures where objections to Christianity, for example, are quite different. And my final point on that, I suppose, would be that that's exactly what we see in the New Testament. So when the Apostle Paul, for example, is dealing with Jews who don't believe the message that he's proclaiming about Jesus, he gives one kind of response. He goes to the Old Testament scriptures and he tries to argue and reason and debate with them, and this is all through the book of Acts, that in fact Jesus is the Messiah. When he's dealing with Greeks in a different culture, he deals with a different set of arguments, and he tries to point to creation, point to God. If you look at Acts 17, for example, you get a different kind of reason that he's giving for his faith and that which he uses in a Jewish context. So I think you're right. I think we need to be sensitive to the culture in which we present these arguments. But I would want to emphasize that I don't think not doing it would be an option.
Two questions. One is, so if Dawkins is defined faith as being belief in the absence of evidence,
yeah.
From a mathematical perspective, is there any probability evidence of the possibility of the multiverse? Because that seems to me to be belief in the absence of evidence. It's just a hypothesis that there might be so many universes out there that eventually you're going to end up with one that's supposed to be life. So that's the first part.
Okay.
The second is the idea of the integration. You're right. I suppose if you take the sort of the axiom that nature is red and tooth and claw, there seems to be an awful lot of the natural world that just is tectonic based shift.
Yeah.
Things eat one another. Are those things related? You know, did those things happen because of human rebellion? That seems, you know, quite a non sequitur. And if not, then could it not have been better integrated if you have this relationship between the creator and the natural world
and
science? So I suppose the first one is about, is there probability for a multiverse? The second one is nature being the way nature just seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not related to human rebellion, then now you might say it is, but if it's not, could it not have been just better integrated?
Okay. Yeah, thanks for those. Two nice easy questions. Right, thanks for that. Let me take the first one on multiverses. I mean, that's a huge topic in itself. And there is a huge amount of debate about that in the scientific community. I think if you go back maybe 10, 15 years, there would have been a huge amount more scepticism about this, that it would have been considered just to be metaphysics that had no sort of scientific basis and that could never possibly be verified scientifically or anything like that. And there's still quite a lot of that scepticism around, I think, amongst scientists. What some people are saying in response to this is, well, we're not just proposing a multiverse to explain away the fine tuning or something like that. They're saying that multiple universes arise naturally out of some of the cosmological theories we have around. So, I think there are good reasons to be sceptical about the whole enterprise, but I don't want to say scientists should stop looking at them, that it's definitely off the radar or something like that. My point would just be that given how tentative it is, how speculative it is, it's very weak as an attempt to explain away the fine-tuning as evidence for a creator. So that would be the main point. I suppose the other thing here, though, is that even if you do have a multiverse, I think you do run into problems with probability, just to pick up on that point, because it's not at all clear that we would expect to observe, the probability of observing a universe like ours would be, it would still be very low, arguably, given a multiverse. Which we can talk about more later if you wish. And furthermore, a multiverse may itself well require a designer in the first place, so I really don't think it helps very much as an argument against God. The second point about the integration model and nature being red and tooth and claw and so forth, could it not have been better integrated? I think one of the things there is, well, what are the resources that a Christian has for explaining it? Given this sort of evidence will be accounted for by an evolutionary perspective. So there are two questions to ask. One, does the evidence itself undermine belief in God? I'm not at all sure that it does. This would be without trying to appeal to this being a result of human rebellion. Could God have had reasons for permitting that? I think we have to be very careful about taking our notion as humans of suffering and taking a sort of anthropomorphic view of that with regard to animal suffering. That there could be no reason that God could have for allowing animal suffering. I think there may well be various reasons that God could have for permitting that. It's not at all clear to me anyway that an all-loving and all-good God would have no reason for allowing animal suffering. But also the explanation, the alternative explanation in terms of evolution, well, would that or does that undermine God? And I don't think so. I mean, again, whatever take people might have on evolution, it just seems to me that evolution requires all sorts of features of the world to be in place in terms of laws of nature, life in the first place, and so forth, that again makes it very weak. Not that it's a problem necessarily for evolution, that's a separate debate, but very weak in terms of its ability to explain away the need for God.
Okay, thank you. Another question? Maybe if somebody's burning to ask another one more after that, because we're making you work awfully hard, and you're doing great, of course. Maybe it's just the same thing as Barry and just...
I'm sorry. I guess all of these models are used to explain away, in a way.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I guess that's fine.
And my question would just be how to practically engage with that. The atheist movement that says science is there will be God. How do we engage that practically?
Good question. I think the starting point is asking a question. So let's start with this. I mean, it's a very simplified version of what Dawkins says, but I think it does go something like this. You know, to appeal to science is explaining so much about the world, and then somehow in there, even if not mentioning Occam's razor, to somehow appeal to that or to explaining away to say that you just need science and there's no longer any need for God. Now, I think my first question would just be to say, well, why do you think that? Why do you think that the scientific theory gets rid of the need for God? Actually, I think his reasons for this are very weak. One of them boils down to saying that, it doesn't matter. In fact, even in evolution, which is Dawkins' strong point, right? I mean, he makes such a big deal of evolution as undermining belief in God. But even there, he looks at some of the complexity involved in life, and he says, going back to the point that was made earlier, that it requires a lot of luck along the way. I nearly fell off my chair when I read this in The God Delusion. But he talks about large infusions of luck at various stages at the origin of life and at various stages along the way to greater complexity. Now, he certainly doesn't mean that as attacking evolution. That's obvious, given that it's Dawkins. But major infusions of luck. What are the chances of intelligent life coming about as a result of all these major infusions of luck? So even in the case of evolution, I think Dawkins is on very weak ground to think that this is any reason to undermine belief in God. And that's in addition to the fact that evolution itself requires a fine-tuned universe, it requires the right kind of planet, it requires all of these laws and so forth to be in place. So, That would be some pointers, I suppose, would be to try to challenge the new atheists in terms of why exactly they would think that. They think you can sort of automatically make this move from the success of science to there being no need for God, whereas I think there's all sorts of needs for God still in terms of the scientific laws, but also for accounting for the evidence of the natural world more generally.
Okay, thank you. Any last questions? I think we'll have to restrict it to one more. Okay, Peter?
Yes, if your theory of God that you have in your diagram there is one of a literal Genesis, young earth creator, creationist view, would you still, is that going to weaken the link in your little arrow between God and science? And those two become mutually exclusive, therefore?
Good question. I think it's interesting that when you look at the indirect conflict model, which, as I pointed out, I think is a weakness. I think I don't think it's the best model in terms of how Christians should think about it. It has the most scope for explaining away. And so, if you are convinced of scientific explanations like evolution, then that will at least potentially, although I've just argued that mightn't even be the case, but potentially it might explain away or undermine your reason for belief in God. But of course, who can play this game? If you're convinced that there are very good reasons for belief in God, then you might work this argument the other way and say, well, the science, we're not too sure about it. And because we know this explanation to be true, this actually explains away some of science. And so arguably this indirect conflict model is a sort of captures some of the objections to evolution that you might find not so much in the young earth creationist movement, but in the intelligent design movement, actually. Where there strong belief in a design hypothesis is undermining their belief in evolution. I think if you go to the young earth viewpoint, of course in many cases they will still adopt something like an integration model. It's not as if young earth creationists are rejecting all of science. But certainly in the case of evolution, then I think you'll come up with something that is even more in conflict than this. They'll just say that evolution is directly in conflict with, not with belief in God, but with particular beliefs about Genesis. So I'm not sure if that quite answers your question, but I think some of this kind of conflict and explaining away is relevant to some of those sorts of issues as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Maybe we thank Dr. Glass in the usual way. I've no doubt that if you still have some burning questions, you could come and ask them afterwards. You're very welcome to stay around for a little while, and there may even be some biscuits left, I'm not certain. If before we finish, I could just say a couple of things. First of all, this spring will be the first of three God and Science lectures. In March, the date is the 24th of March, also a Tuesday, we have Professor David Bell come to speak on artificial intelligence. You maybe noticed that a few people have been saying in the media that AI might wipe the earth out and that kind of thing. Well, we in CIS are ahead of the game because we already had Dr. Bell to come to speak to us, arranged by then. So come and hear what he has to say about artificial intelligence and how it relates to the Christian faith. In April, we have Dr. Martin Groot, who's with us, former director of the Armagh Observatory, who'll be speaking on a topic. I think we're still considering the title, is that right? But it'll be an astronomical subject. Yeah, okay. So that's on the 28th of April. Also, this spring, and we don't know the date yet, we're expecting Professor David Livingstone from the Queen's Department of Geography to deliver the Walton Lecture. The Walton Lecture is a CIS initiative in Ireland and is named after Ernest Walton, who was a physicist, Nobel Prize winner, an Irishman, and a Christian. So that's the Walton Lecture, and keep looking out on the CIS website. It'll be both here and in Dublin.
Okay.
Yes, both here and in Dublin. We haven't got the yet. Just before we finish this whole bit, could just say a couple more things. It's great to see some people I think we haven't seen before, so you're most welcome. And there are also a few old hands that we recognise. We're keen to make this a little bit more integrated, and we're wondering about a few ideas of including others. For example, if you've read a great book and you want to give a 5-minute book review, if you've got a story to tell about your life in science and faith and maybe you could be interviewed and share something that's happened, then let us know. We're also very keen that this doesn't just be a club for people who simply have a faith science interest. This should be a service to the Christian Church, and we'd like to somehow join up with churches so that anybody who isn't a scientist but who is a little bit concerned about science might have some kind of way of seeing that there are people who are scientists and who are very happy Christians as well and see no conflict at all. And I think that's a very important task for this organisation, and if you can help, if you can join us up, that'll be super. If you want to be kept in touch, please let Dr. Ethel White here know your email address, and we'll keep you connected. And I finally might say that there's a tin sitting there. I think there's nothing in it at the moment, but if there's anything you want to contribute to that tin before you go, that would be very welcome. But it's not obligatory. But I can't think of anything else I want to say unless Ethel needs to remind me. No. Barry.
Two shameless plugs. The first is that Dr. Glass's cohort, Mark McCartney, the University of Ulster, was part of this project, Science God Explained Away. He's coming to the chaplaincy here on Sunday, the 15th of February, to look at the mathematical model of analysing the decline in religious affiliation in the islands of Ireland. He did a bit of this at the day that David and Mark organised in October, but he's coming back to look at that on Sunday morning here in the chaplaincy, and anyone is welcome to come along for that from about 10:30 or 10:45 start. So that's the first shameless plug. It's kind of very much related to what we're doing that evening. And the second is, if you're in any way, shape or form interested in the mission of the church in Northern Ireland, the chaplaincy's home evening in the Great Hall here at Queen's University on Monday the 16th of February, and that's between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock, and we have leaders of four traditional denominations on the island, with the Church of Ireland Archbishop of Armagh, we have Heather Morris, former Methodist
So if you want to get along to that, let us know, because we're reserving seats in the Great Hall. And you can do that, you can see the website on the way out, clubdelfast.org, and you can email the manager, manager@clubdelfast.org, or just call the county or county, or just send your email and your email. But just to let you know if that's wrong.
Okay, and thanks again to Barry for hosting us. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. See you next time.